Hi, everybody. Welcome. Welcome. Is everybody having a good time?
Yes.
Is this freaking awesome or what? We're back in person. This is so fantastic. I'm Gail Milburn. I'm one of your governing committee members. I'm also a BJCP North Rep representative for the North Region, which is Michigan, West, and then Western Canada and Alaska. So glad to see everybody here today. We are going to be talking about the future of the BJCP guidelines and where things are sitting now and where they're going in the future. I'd like to, again, welcome you. Welcome to HomebrewCon. This is fantastic. And I'd just like to make sure that everybody mutes their cell phones and electronic devices beforehand, because Gordon actually loses his train of thought very easily. Kidding.
I'm going to pick on him, too. Don't worry.
We all pick on Gordon. Also want to let you know that there will be questions afterward, but we ask that you step up to the microphone in order to be a part of the recording that we'll have archived at the American Homebrewers Association. There is the QR code for the archive. If you'd like to snap that so that you have that for future reference, that would be great. And also, at the end of the survey, please make sure that you fill out the feedback for this session. It's a very easy feedback, couple of questions to give your feedback to the AHA and to the speakers. I am very honored and pleased to announce that we, for the first time, have Julia Hirse as being our executive director for the American Homebrewers Association. We are so lucky to have her. Most of you know her from the BA side, from the Brewers Association side, where she served as the craft beer program director for a number of years. Julia, many of you might not know that Julia is also a certified beer judge, and she has been a beer judge for many, many years. And we're very lucky to have someone on, as the executive director who is also part of the BJCP judging pool. She judged this week at the Homebrew Comp, and it was fun to see her over there actually putting in the work that we were hoping that she would put in her spare time.
I'm here to work!
In her spare time. Julia is also an advanced Cicerone. She's an award-winning homebrewer, and she's also the lead architect of the Brewers Association National Beer Holidays, which you might know as Learn to Homebrew Day and Mead Day and our wonderful Big Brew Day. And Julia graduated from the University of South Florida with a degree in broadcast journalism. And she worked at CNN in Washington early on in her career. She's married, she's got two children, and she lives in Lyons, Colorado. Gordon, I'm going to try not to poke too much fun at Gordon. I've known Gordon for a long time. He has roped me into a lot of different things. Gordon is the president emeritus of the BJCP. He has been part of our past presidency for a number of years. If you have ever looked at the style guidelines, it's his baby. Gordon is the highest-ranking BJCP judge. He's now at, I think, 14. We just stopped making pins for Gordon. He's just got the Gordon pin. So he is the highest-ranking BJCP judge, and I dare say one of the hardest-working. He is the principal author of the BJCP guidelines that we'll be discussing today, and he'll be presenting where we're going in the future. And we're just really lucky to have both Julia and Gordon here to talk about what's happening with the BJCP going forward. Thank you very much. Enjoy.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. I would love to lead and start with that this is a great opportunity to, I think, learn from Gordon and certainly other BJCP judges and officers are in this room on the beer style guidelines based on BJCP. Other style guidelines certainly will come up in our conversations, but this is something, a body of work that really defines a lot of what we do as homebrewers. So I couldn't be more pleased that Gordon was willing to do this, and we're going to get into it. We also, for those that are not aware, BJCP style guidelines have recently been updated, December of 2021. So we refer to those as the 2021 BJCP style guidelines. Those were not used this year at the National Homebrew Competition. BJCP, and Gordon can fill this in, gives 6 months generally for competitions that are going to use any of the guidelines to adopt to the newest. So you would look in the future for the 2021 to be adopted and used, and I look forward to scrambling my brain again and having the deck of cards not thrown up in the air, but sift and settle where I embody and own as a BJCP judge and a Cicerone those guidelines, but it certainly takes time. So we're gonna get into it. And Gordon, I mean, you can lead us off with what you would love to set the room and the stage, but what I want to get at is, you know, what's the value of beer styles in the first place as a great place to start once you do your introduction?
Yeah, thanks, Julia. Got me now?
No.
We'll go with this one. How y'all doing? Thanks for coming out. I appreciate Gail's introduction. I remember when she was a brand new judge, and I was happy to mentor her along, and I'm very proud to see her stepping up to the highest levels of the organization. I've known Julia for probably 20 years. One curious fact is that we sort of met each other through Mead, and when we were first starting to offer a Mead judging program through the BJCP, Julia was working with me on setting that up, and we shared quite a few Meads together and some conferences. Maybe I have notes of them. I don't really have direct memories, but so they must have been pretty good. When we talk about what's the value of styles, what I like to say is that we've always had styles. I mean, styles existed before we wrote about them. But really, what we're talking about is a common language for discussing beer. So if I call something a triple, you don't have to say, well, what's a triple? You know there's a definition somewhere that you can look up, and it sets an image in your mind. If I handed you a beer that was black and I told you it was a triple, you'd probably be confused because that one word carried with it a large amount of meaning. So the beer styles that the BJCP put together, the reasons we had them to start with was really as a reference for conducting homebrew competitions, right? Because you have to have something to evaluate the beers against. Otherwise, it's just like going to a People's Choice Award at a beer festival. And as my friend Ray Daniels used to say, you're not going to win there unless your beer is big or goofy or both. He actually said that, and it's true. The beer guidelines had another purpose within the BJCP because the BJCP's principal purpose is as a certifying organization for judges to tell the world that a person passing it is a competent evaluator of beer. So it's used as an exam reference. Everybody that studies for the BJCP exam has to understand the guidelines among many other references, but the style guidelines are the principal reference that we use for all style-related questions. And its further purpose is, since the BJCP is a nonprofit organization, its mission is primarily educational, we offer those freely to anyone, the public in general, people that want to learn about beer styles. So that's the area where they've really been used well beyond our original expectations. So while they were originally used for homebrew competitions, now we see them used in commercial competitions. We see them used internationally. Consumers use them. There are various apps that people use as reference, trade groups, vendors. You go buy yeast from one of the major yeast suppliers here. You go to their website, and they'll be indexing their products according to the styles. And we think that's great. The more that people are able to use them, the better. And that's why the guidelines aren't something we're trying to shake people down over, you know, not trying to make money off of it, because, you know, the educational mission has them out there to the world. So that sort of begs the question of then what aren't the style guidelines? People sometimes misinterpret what they are, and I hear them like talking about, well, it's telling brewers what to brew, it's limiting them, it's stifling creativity, and it's actually quite the opposite. So guidelines are just that. They're not specifications. They're not something you have to meet or you fail. They're sort of rules of thumb, or where the bulk of examples of a type of beer lie. But those things can change over time. They're not meant to categorize every commercial beer. Not every beer has a place, and that's okay. And in no way are we trying to dictate to brewers. So oftentimes, we get sort of hate mail from, people that have either judges or consumers or just people out there communicating with them start, like, using the style guidelines as a club, going to the brewers and saying, well, you didn't follow this, boom, boom, boom. It's, it doesn't work that way. So if people understood the purpose of them, I think it would be better. The way I like to call the guidelines is what it really is. It's a categorization system for beer that just happens to have detailed sensory profiles attached. Full stop. So you can find lots of descriptions of beers of the world, but do you ever really find the descriptions of what you would expect in sufficient detail that if you were a judge in a competition, you have a reference? And that's where the troubles come in, is you can talk about beer styles, but if you can't completely describe them, then you can't really use them in a competition very well, or it just sort of comes down to personal preference, and we're trying to avoid that.
So appreciate that overview, and I'm going to ask the next question by first prefacing the question, so then I'll toss it to you, Gordon. And you'll get it why I want to preface it when I ask it, but I want Gordon to answer for us, what's the history of beer styles as defined by the BJCP? That last piece is important. I do think it's significant here. You've got Gordon talking about beer styles. Tomorrow, don't miss Dennis Mitchell, 10:15, demystifying the BJCP exam. Dennis is the current president. And, BJCP and the relevance to homebrewing is the guiding light of the guidelines. However, American Homebrewers Association, who is related to the Professional Brewers Association, the Brewers Association, we still, on the AHA level, still choose to follow the BJCP guidelines, as that's part of the homebrewing, I think, DNA, is those guidelines for homebrewers, as opposed to the BA, our organization's guidelines, which are for professional brewing competitions. So what I refer to as the BA World Beer Styles that are updated yearly, right, where BJCP style guidelines, as Gordon will explain, the years that have been in between updates, it's a very different process. It's a very different set of guidelines. Charlie Papazian, certainly the founder of the Great American Beer Festival and past president of the Brewers Association, you know, had his hands in both, frankly. But in creating the BA World Beer Styles that then get broken out for GABF or World Beer Cup, to me, they're not as ingredient-centric. I feel like Charlie has told me in the past when I asked him about it, you know, Curious George, little young homebrewer, Julia, like, hey, Charlie, why, you know, BJCP, it's just easier for me to study. I can know how to reproduce the flavors based on the ingredients section of every style guideline. You know, Mr. Relax, Don't Worry, Have a Home Brew, Zen Master Charlie is like, I'm not going to, you know, we shouldn't tell brewers how to get to those flavors. So that's me. Don't quote me on that as Charlie's quote, but that's me in the spirit of what his answer back to me was. So I think that's really important to mention is that, A, beer style guidelines are defined not just by one organization, right? The BA professional, BJCP, home brewer. World organizations in many countries have their own style guidelines. So I think that's a fair place to put it when I ask Gordon the history, because Gordon could give us the history of many guidelines and organizations that have come their way. The last piece is in 1985 when the BJCP started. The AHA was right there, you know, co-founding that. And then the two organizations had a bit of a divergence over the years. And I historically respect history. But the reason, I mean, I think I insisted that Gordon and I label this talk of, you know, past, present, and the future of beer styles is because I want to get to the future of homebrewing. I don't want to live in the past. I want to get to the future of the organizations, you know, on the national level, including AHA and BJCP, and what we can do here forward for homebrewers. So I think that's really good basis from my perspective of history, but it's good to learn from the past and look at the past. So with that, Gordon, what's the history of the BJCP styles?
Yeah, the phrase beer style hasn't been out there that long. The earliest I can really find is Michael Jackson in his first World Guide to Beer in 1977 used the phrase beer style, but it was almost in passing. You know, it wasn't a major part of how he described things. That came later. I mean, certainly he was describing the beers that were discovered or existed, and it's like a documentation project. You've done some research, and you're trying to put some structure around categorizing it. So he first used the word beer style, and then a little bit later, Fred Eckhart published a book, The Essentials of Beer Styles, that also helped introduce that to Americans. So, as Julia said, the BJCP was founded in 1985, and competitions were conducted with, you know, very limited guidelines. The description of beers was often maybe a paragraph at best, and sometimes it would actually describe the beer, but sometimes the description back then might just talk about the history of the beer or what part of the world it's from. And judges were expected to sort of know those kind of things. So there was some evolution over the years in the amount of detail and rigor that went into the guidelines. So as Julia also said, the BJCP split off from AHA sponsorship in the 90s, 1995 to be specific. And the BJCP published its own independent guidelines first in 1997. And we can find those early guidelines on the BJCP website if you drill down into some of the history sections. And the first ones were very, like I said, often just a paragraph. It wasn't until 1999 when the first real detailed guidelines came out, and that's ones where guidelines have the now familiar aroma, appearance, flavor, mouthfeel, other section. Before then, those didn't exist in style descriptions that were published. So that structure came in. In 2000, the AHA made that decision to stop with their own homebrewing guidelines, because there were two separate sets of guidelines and actually two different competition registration systems, which were confusing. So as part of the work we did in the early 2000s of the reconciliation of the BJCP with the AHA and becoming friends and partners again, like we should have been all along, the AHA continued to support the use of the BJCP guidelines for homebrew competitions, and also having a single competition registration system the BJCP administered. So there were new releases after these first ones that I talked about after 1999. I became involved with them in the year 2003. I took over as the chairman of the style committee, who looked at updates, and we put out our first edition of that in 2004. That was later updated in 2008. A minor update with a little bit of...
None of the BJCP updates are minor, Gordon. None.
What I call, major updates mean we change category names and numbers, and you have to relearn, American Pale Ale is this number, not this other number. Sorry for those who had to relearn them at some point in time. So new things were added over the years. The 2015 guidelines was a major update where a lot of things changed. And one of the things we did in that edition was we brought in more international references. As we understood, as we saw the guidelines being used throughout the world, we realized it had a very U.S.-centric feel to it. So that made it very difficult for other countries to use it. And the sort of irony there is, imagine a British beer competition describing British styles from an American point of view, and the beer's getting rated poorly because what we were really describing was what we would find in a U.S. store. So oftentimes we were describing heavily oxidized beers as if that was what they should taste like. So if over the time you ever wondered why British beers were described less as caramely and more as fruity, is because that's what they actually taste like over there. The caramel that we got in a lot of those beers was really just oxidation from old samples, and you live and you learn, and you make those corrections. So those were some of the things that were brought in these new updates. And as Julia said, 2021, we just put out the latest edition, and in that one, the focus was on rewriting all the descriptions, not necessarily changing the categorization system, so looking for more consistency across all the categories, but also in making sure that the ways that people used it in competition, the frequently asked questions that we'd get, the confusing points out there, those got clarified. So, hopefully...
Jury's still out, Gordon. We'll get back to you on how the updates are going.
Well, you just have to start using them, and we'll find out. But, and we want these things to be as correct as we can, and that's when we make these changes. So that's what I see as the history of the guidelines from the BJCP standpoint.
Very helpful to set the stage on the further conversation of what we're going to cover. I also am remiss to not mention the Cicerone program in all of this. In 2007, when Ray Daniels left the Brewers Association, I actually filled his job as craft beer program director. He was also Brewers Publications editor. But Ray left, started the Cicerone program. When you're starting the beer world's version of Wine Sommelier, you kind of need beer styles, right? And so he didn't build out of the gates, I think, the entire syllabus system. Many of us know Advanced, for example, the third of four levels got added later. He had to, I think, get his footing. So Cicerone started front and center of always BJCP style guidelines are what we use. But as you test and advance in the program, you are also expected to be aware of Brewers Association style guidelines. And I think it's intelligent, although maddening, because the BA guidelines are updated on a yearly basis. Our updates, though, you know, 1 year we had 600 updates, but it was textual updates from judges and stewards and commercial brewers. So the BJCP, and it's just a nature of the process, what we're covering here in approach, they're not going to add styles as quickly as a set of style guidelines that is updating on a yearly basis. You will also note, and I remember being excited where I was the one that got to release the news, I think it was my blog post tied to a press release, that the BA finally added juicy or hazy. Juicy or hazy pale, juicy or hazy IPA, juicy or hazy double. The exponential discussions that went on behind the scenes on not putting that to an appellation, that's a different discussion for a different day. But the BA took many years to add that. 2021, I know, in scanning at it, Gordon can talk about it. This is not the question I'm going to ask him, but like brewed IPA was added in 2021. You know, how hot is brewed IPA right now, right? So it took BJCP from 2015 to 2021 to add a style that might not even be around in 5 to 7 years, but that's okay. You know, it's the nature of the process. So I just want to eke in, though, that Cicerone follows both. And as you advance, the BA ones keep you more up to date, I think, on maybe trends that are indicative in the marketplace. But the BJCP, as a homebrewing-centric set of guidelines, has the right and privilege to not worry too much about the marketplace and more so be paying attention to what homebrewers are brewing. And so that's why I'm excited to get to know the homebrewing trends through national homebrew competition entries and whatever data we can have the BJCP sharing with us over years on what style trends are going on from entrants. So with that, you know, Gordon, why do beer styles change over time in the first place?
Right. Thanks for mentioning the Cicerone program for people that were involved in that. There was actually Ray Daniels and I had a discussion in 2006 or 7 at an NEC conference. He pulls me aside and he says, I'm working on this new project. I can't tell you exactly what it is, but we want to know like whether or not there's any issue with us like using BJCP guidelines to tell people about beer styles. And it's like, no problem at all. This is fully within the mission. And, you know, he was trying this, I don't like the term, swim lanes, but we were trying to not step on each other's toes. That he said he wasn't producing an organization to certify judges, and we said we're not trying to get into certifying people in the commercial space. So, you know, we sort of had a handshake agreement on that, and happy to see him using the guidelines. So that's part of the background. Before I answer the question about why styles change over time, I just wanted to mention quickly a little background because I'm going to use these terms. The guidelines that we have are organized into different groups. We have classic styles, which you might think of as real beer styles, and specialty styles, which are styles where you're, you know, trying to be creative and you're adding other things to an existing beer style, or you're sort of inventing something.
Like brewed IPA.
Yeah.
I'm just keeping it light.
We have some styles that are, I'll call them extensible, that we can add to. We have specialty IPA where we've slotted brewed IPA into. We also have a historical beer category where we've added things over the years. Our guidelines allow for local styles, which are emerging styles that are coming out of different countries in the world. People that want to hold BJCP competitions might have a local style that they want to use, but that style isn't exported or well known. So we added it in there to give them some recognition, but without having it be one of the main styles that is actually appears on the BJCP exam. We have this notion of provisional styles that we added, which is sort of the web-based release. It's a way that we can put out things we're working on, new styles, between the major releases of the guidelines. So, to answer the question directly, why do styles change? It's because the beers themselves are changing and evolving. Either we're learning more about styles that have existed, or styles are rapidly changing. Some commercial examples get discontinued or change. And often we see new published research about historical styles that we're able to take advantage of. Early on, the guidelines were almost like a book report. We were, you know, let's see what Michael Jackson said about, like, Flanders Red. And, okay, here we go. Let's describe this. Later editions involved more field research, direct tastings of, you know, can we try these styles in the country of origin of what they're intended to be, not just as they appear in the U.S. import market. So we have been able to incorporate new research, both ours and external, and pull from new published references. We also pull in, we see the styles used in competitions, and we see where the problem areas are. We see what questions entrants are asking, and we hear judges when they say, you know, I think this beer is, you know, not entered properly. So we listen to that and try to make the styles a little bit easier to use. So styles are changing because we're learning more about them. You know, and more as they change and more as historical ones are uncovered. There are people that look back on historical styles and write about them. My friend Ron Pattinson has helped me on some of the research on these, and he loves writing about these things that are hundreds of years old. So I'm happy to have his help in this as well. So styles change because beers change.
I like that answer. I will also say, in my, you know, lens to the world of being a student of beer, I think culturally with the craft beer movement, started in the United States, now globally many brewers are you know, leaning on the notion of craft, more flavorful beer. I just think that the entire groupthink, the culture of beer knowledgeable people, are able to take us to deeper places, are able to get to more nooks and crannies of what's gone on in beer historically and where beer is today. So I think that also has kind of sped up the pace of the change of style guidelines, if that makes sense. All right, so where do you see it all going?
Fortunately, we're not in the prediction business, so I couldn't have predicted, like, the whole hazy thing that seemed like a regional fad for a while. As far as I know, that could have gone the way of black IPA, which, when if some of you were around 2015 when I first talked about that, I had this joke slide of, you know, here are the change, you know, here are the new styles in the 2015 guideline. It's like, number one, black IPA. Number two, not black IPA. You know, because that's all we ever heard about. Before that time, we had this category. It was category 23, experimental beer, and, you know, that thing was where black IPAs got entered, and nothing else would ever win because it was there. You know, so there was a huge demand, and we added it. Now the only place I see them is South America, surprisingly enough. And they're actually pretty good down there. So styles can come out and they can go away. We were in the process of building a brewed IPA style for our next publication, but it was created and died all within the time between updates. Hmm. But some people ask that we include it anyway because it's a style, it existed, somebody could make it, and if they do, wouldn't it be nice if you had a reference that you could judge it against? So that's one case where the BJCP is trying to have sort of an encyclopedia of available styles that could be judged. We're not trying to really describe the market at any particular time. And I think that's what gives us the little bit of flexibility to say we don't have to do updates every year.
Yeah, it's a deep question. I really would be interested to hear where you all think it's going. I tend to lean these days, with certainly more freedoms in my day-to-day life of being a home brewer, to flex my fermentation muscle, not just to be in the beer lanes, right? Fermentation arts is what we're seeing. You see talks at this conference that are not just beer. You see styles being covered by BJCP that are not beer. So, you know, fast forward in your spaceship to 2050, don't have the answers, but I love to think that there's a kind of a spectrum of one or two directions, and I just don't know where we'll land. Beer-flavored beer, right? Maybe we land there. Maybe it really does get back to the basics of the classic styles. You know, you have provisional and local really always pushing the edge and whatnot and specialty, but that the culture of the those in the beer space keep it towards beer-flavored beer. I see wine being much more capable of that. They're so traditionally uptight that it's hard for, you know, a lot of wine people to probably get anywhere but what I just described. But then there's the other end of the spectrum, where a reason we're all in beer is the experimentation of why we're here. And so what do those style guidelines look like in 2050? Wow. Fascinating, certainly, to just think about. So regardless of where it goes, Gordon, you know, what's the process to approve the style changes on the BJCP side year in and year out?
Yeah, this is probably the question I get asked most when I travel to different countries and talk about this, because people are often trying to get us to approve some local style that may or may not actually exist. So here are some of the questions that we like to ask. Number one, is it actually real? Is this something that's being produced, or is it conceptual or aspirational? So I want to know, is it commercially produced? Is it distributed? Is it made by homebrewers? Does this actually show up in competitions? Do you have some competition entry data that shows that these styles are showing up in specialty categories? Because I could certainly see, as I described before we added black IPA, if I pulled up the specialty category, more than half of them were black IPA. So that was sort of screaming to me, hey, we ought to break these out because it's looking like a style and less like a specialty thing. Once we get over that hurdle, that, okay, it's real, it's made by homebrewers, there's a demand, it's like, do we have enough examples that we can build a detailed sensory profile? Because otherwise we're back to just like the one paragraph description, and we could acknowledge a style is out there, but if we can't give a reference to judges, is that really helpful or not? So and that's where I think like the provisional styles can come in handy. It lets us put out something that may not be as fully complete as we would like it to be. Maybe, you know, we think they're changing a little rapidly, but at least it gives something that we can put out there and start using, and use that to gather feedback. If there's a new style that somebody's proposing, sometimes I hear from countries like one time I was in Ireland, they're like, well, let us tell you about our Irish pale ale. And, you know, what is it? Well, it's like an English pale ale, but it's using Irish malt. Well, what's Irish malt taste like? Well, it tastes like English malt. Then, you know, if I put these glasses down in front of you, could you really tell the difference? Well, this one's in Ireland. It's like, well, suppose it didn't have a label on it. So we want to make sure there's sufficient space. We've spent a lot of time trying to make it difficult to enter one beer in multiple places by creating separation between these styles to make it easier for judges. That the thing I hate to see the most in a competition is the judge say, this beer's out of style and I'm not going to judge this. Like, no, you can write down what you perceive and you might tell them it's better entered somewhere else, but, do your job. Judge that beer. So we want to make it easy that way, and by avoiding style overlap is the best way, I think. And finally, if we haven't actually tasted it and validated the profile, we can only go so far, because sometimes people submit styles to us and it sounds great, but I'd like to know, it's not necessarily coming from a trustworthy source. So I'd like to go out and field test it and try some samples. And, when I travel, if somebody's talking about this, the first thing I say is, get every example you can find. Let's set up a tasting panel. And I'll start mapping out everything I'm tasting and see, is this something that we can build? So that's how we go about looking at whether or not a style that somebody suggests to us is something that we want to add.
So I hear us and we in that, and we're going to get to that in a little bit of who that is and who can be part of the us and we, because I think in an ever-evolving world, culturally, marginalized populations and many women have been cut out of the story. And so Gordon's going to explain to us how any one of us could roll up our sleeves and be a part of the us and we, which is great. But before that, I think it's helpful. You just described, evaluating proposed style guidelines, but what's an easy way to say, why styles wouldn't end up in the guidelines?
So it could be they're too new. They're still changing, that we can't actually put a pin on it. Call it trying to catch a falling knife. That's one of the reasons why we delayed adding the hazy, juicy New England IPA style, is it just seemed to be changing rapidly. So as soon as we wrote a description, brewers were making it differently, and the commercial examples that we would cite would be out of style for the description we just wrote. So we kind of wanted to see some of the styles settle down a little bit. Is it a true fad, like brewed IPA that showed up, was hot for a week and a half, and then disappeared? Or does it actually have some legs to it? So that churn that you see in the style could keep it out of the guidelines, at least temporarily. If homebrewers aren't making it, Some people talk about, and this could have been something that had to do with the brewed IPAs. Well, you have to go out and get this special enzyme that commercial brewers get. Maybe they'll let you have some, and there's some other processes that homebrewers might not have access to that go into certain styles. So that could keep it out of it. So if homebrewers aren't making it, then we don't see sort of a demand for it. We're less likely to prioritize it. Styles cannot be there because we just haven't had enough samples to try or research data to support it, that we basically can't validate that sensory profile. And we did put the quote in the last edition to sort of signal to some people in countries who would come to us and say, well, our beer industry is growing and we really want your support, so we'd like you to create this new style so people will make it. It's like, okay, maybe it's this American metaphor of the cart and the horse, and they certainly had that backwards. We're describing things that are made, not things that we hope will be made. So he said, we don't create styles in the hopes that they'll become popular. The state of the overall beer market in any given country, including the U.S., isn't our concern. It's like the market will take care of itself, and we're describing what's actually out there. We're not trying to get in front of it, because remember, when I said we're not telling brewers what to make, we mean it. So we're trying to describe what has been made.
Okay, very helpful. Few more slides, 15 minutes left, and we want to leave room and time for questions. We also do need to end this on time because we have the day two closing speaker back in the spirit of Pittsburgh Ballroom at 3. So with that, Gordon, you know, how do people, any walk of life that's knowledgeable enough to know their way to find the BJCP, how do they, you know, help in supporting beer style updates?
Yeah, we have on our last slide with the contacts, we have a style@bjcp.org email box. People can send in corrections, updates, suggestions. We go through those every time we do an update to make sure that they've been looked at. We don't take every suggestion, but we do read everyone. And if people want to invite us to some place where they think a style exists that we can get into it, that's great. If a local group wants to write up a draft of a new style submission, you know, send it in. That's, you know, we have this mailbox that like receives this input, and we will look it over carefully.
All right. How often do you decide to update the guidelines? Why did 2015, that I finally got used to, change to 2021? What's the deal?
Yeah. Sometimes people ask about, like, well, the BA updates their guidelines every year. Why doesn't the BJCP? And then I usually give them the cheeky response of, well, how often does the BA change their exam? BA doesn't have an exam. So imagine how hard it is for people to relearn guidelines, and now imagine that you're being tested on that in a formal setting where you have to spend a couple of hours writing essays and things like that. So you want to talk about trying to catch a falling knife or chase the wallet on a string thing. You know, we have to have some stability for people studying for the exams and competitions. You heard here of the NHC, it's like, well, we haven't used it yet. So we'd always be in the case where we're chasing the last edition. We also have many, many, many translations and external versions, things that appear in apps. A lot of dependencies, basically, that upon whenever we change, those have to get cranked through, often from people that aren't in the BJCP doing that work. So, you know, we'd like to give people time to do that and then have some stability before we make them go through it again. So we find a cadence of about 5 years seems about right. We'd like to have it sooner, but this seems to be a good balance. And we try to alternate between major updates and minor updates, or major updates and more major updates.
Thank you for admitting that.
Yeah.
I've got other questions that I would want to toss to Gordon, but out of respect for time and to get what's on your mind, I'll go to the last slide. So, you know, it's not just BJCP, because Beer Judge Certification Program certainly recognizes meat and cider in a robust way. So what's next for meat and cider?
Yeah. So when we did the 2021 update for beer, we didn't touch meat and cider as part of that because we wanted to get the beer part published. So we're actively working on meat and cider. Cider is the one that's further along as of right now. And I'm looking at expanded descriptions, reworking some of the categories. Right now, kind of envisioning 4 cider categories. So like a traditional category where we're looking at sort of the ciders of the world that don't have any other special ingredients, things out of the American, Spanish, English, French traditions. Some ciders are stronger because they've been concentrated somehow, either before fermentation or after. So a whole collection of strong ciders like New England cider, apple wine, but also some other ones that are like ice cider and fire cider, things that are coming out of Quebec that we're seeing. Then a specialty cider category where cider with added ingredients, fruit, spice, experimental, and spices to include hops, because I've seen some nice hop ciders. And then Perry gets its own category, like rather than just there be cider and Perry and like trying to write a description that covers both, have a collection of cider or Perry categories or Perry styles within their own categories. So right now that's kind of what we're looking for, and I really kind of like that organization because I thought things were a little too intertwined before, and this sort of teases them out. So, you know, I don't know how you feel about, like, in the NHC having more categories, but competitions can always combine categories for competition purposes. And in the mead, I think we're looking at a minor rework at best, maybe reworking the historical style by, like, defining Polish mead separately. The one style that I've seen show up more and more in competition that I think deserves its own description is Beauchet, that has a sort of a caramelized honey in it. So just minor updates and adding those sort of two styles, reworking how historical reads is probably what we're looking at mead, but we haven't really dug our teeth into it to the level we had on cider. The goal is to get these things out the door by the end of this year. So that's what I hope to be able to do. And once that's done, then we start the whole thing all over again. We start, you know, we're always continuing to collect data. And we have added an errata page on the BJCP website when we do see like little reported. Thankfully, they tend to be minor and typographical in nature. To put it out there, just to sort of show after we publish this, here's some things that were caught, and so people could see corrections if they built something on the previously published version.
Great to know. So we're going to go to questions. We'll say today 4 to 5 after the AHA member gathering is the BJCP member meeting. So if you're in the Beer Judge Certification Program, please plan to go to that. Where is that? What room? Say it again.
411,
5 o'clock. Great. I also, shameless self-promotion, but I'm excited because 90% of learning is because you taught it. So I'm launching a podcast called A Sense of Beer Style with Jeremy Storton of Good Beer Matters, and it's a podcast based on the 2021 guidelines. We're going through every single style, and we're also doing prepisodes with notions of concepts and lexicon in that to, I think, help bring forth my personal embodiment of the 2021 style guidelines, but stay tuned for that as a resource as well. All right, let's go to questions.
Thank you for the presentation. I had a question about kind of the in-between styles. So I had a beer a number of years ago that was kind of between the Flanders Red and the Oud Bruin style. And so I entered it in both because I wasn't sure which was the best one. And the judge for the Flanders said it should have been entered in Oud Bruin, and Oud Bruin said it should have been entered in Flanders. So I don't know if there's a way
That's why I said this. So yeah, exactly. I could see that one coming a mile away.
I don't know if there's a way to deal with that or if it's something that kind of reflects on me as a brewer. I should try to push it in one of the two directions instead of that.
That.
Okay.
And that's, you know, I wrote about some of these things in Brewing Better Beer about, like, competition entry strategies. You know, if you find yourself straddling the styles, you know, commit. Go one way or the other. Make the beer you're brewing more recognizable to the judge if your goal is to enter in a competition. It could be your goal is just to drink it and then, you know, brew the beer you like.
It ended up getting good reviews in both.
Then I would nudge it closer to one so it's more recognizable, so the judges would likely give you a better score that way.
All right, thanks.
And bring one for me to try.
Thank you for the detail and the talk. My question is about hard seltzers and low alcohol beers. There's certainly zeitgeist around these between Zymergy articles and HomebrewCon talks, and anecdotally, half my homebrew club has dabbled in them. But they're often expressly excluded from competitions. How does the BJCP governance monitor homebrewer activity in those types of beverages?
Competitions are sort of free to accept whatever entries they want, and they can always create their own styles for entry purposes. I don't foresee seltzer categories because it's not really beer. You know, maybe the thinking will change. I'd like to see that it, like, sticks around for, you know, a while, because it could fall into that sort of fad category. Because I don't know that I've necessarily seen the demand. I mean, it could just wind up being another category of beverage, sort of like mead and cider, and maybe that's a better way of dealing with it. But that's sort of a philosophical thing that I think has to get solved, because I don't think we could take the incremental approach of just tacking that on.
Arthur, you can talk to Gordon in the hallway after this and get him to pontificate. I'd love to see that be a fly on the wall.
Yeah, thanks a lot for that.
Yeah.
The question about low alcohol beer was actually one of the ones that I was alluding to about, like, processes that may be available to professional brewers that aren't to home brewers under current technology. It is a trend that we've seen, and it's actually acknowledged in there. If you look in the German lager category under Lichtbier, you see, like, well, in Germany that style has more or less been replaced by, like, the low alcohol, non-alcohol segment. But I don't know that home brewers are able to sort of execute that yet. Could be. It certainly could be. So I would put that in a trend we're aware of and are monitoring, but haven't really decided how to deal with that yet. So if there are any, which is also, you could read that as an invitation to submit a proposed guideline for that. Is like, maybe you're seeing something that we aren't, write it up and send it in, and you know, maybe that'll, like, give us a little, like, nudge in the right direction.
Let's go to the next question, please.
Thank you. My question is kind of more on the opposite side of this, as a home brewer looking at possibly going into a competition. When you're going to look to try and categorize your particular beer, we as home brewers kind of, one of the benefits of home brewing is we can experiment. We can take our style, and I'll kind of quote Dr. Reichert from yesterday morning. We're going to brew up to the edge of the style and then a little bit beyond. So how do we do that to categorize a beer when we've gone a little bit beyond in a style without falling into 34C experimental?
Yeah. This is where, like, having some good judge skills helps, because you might be looking at the specs, but those specs don't necessarily translate into the glass. So unless you can actually distinguish that, like, by tasting it, you know, if it doesn't taste out of style, go for it. But I mean, I really dislike hearing, you know, judges like, oh, you know, I can tell, like, the two IBUs over. No, you can't. Just stop. So, you know, but if you have, like, a, you know, an ordinary bitter and it's like 9%, I think we could tell that. Well, so
in my particular instance, I think if you look going into a wooded beer, it tells you to tell you the base style, and then it, when you read the description, it's well aged either with or without the alcohol flavor of what it's, you know, in the cask or whatever. Well, mine's a 4-day initial fermentation beer, so it's not well aged on wood. So therefore it has to go into other. But it does have a very heavy wood flavor.
Mm.
Thomas, I encourage you to go out in the hall with Gordon after this.
Gordon will see you.
He's never going to make it anywhere. So we're going to run out of time. I want to get to these questions. Sarah, as room monitor, what do we do? Because we are at time, but we have four questions. Okay, I'm going to leave after this question just because I have to introduce Dr. J, but I'd love you to stay because this is where the good content comes from, if you're comfortable to, and still not be late for the 3 o'clock day 2 closing speaker. Go ahead.
Okay, so in the new guidelines versus the old guidelines, you have a couple ABV changes, a couple IBU changes, which makes sense because you can read labels, but you have 33 SRM changes, and 32 of those SRM changes are only changed by a half a point or 1 point. So my question is, how many commercial examples were sent off to a lab to analyze the SRM changes, and which lab was that?
Well, I'm staying for this answer.
None and not applicable.
So what was the group of people and the demographics of that group of people that made those decisions? Or what size of the group?
The SRM things changed because a homebrewer analyzed the table that we had published in it of this color equates to this number, and then was looking, were we applying that consistently? So in some cases, we claimed a number and then described it a certain way. So we were trying to achieve internal consistency with the color of table of color names to SRMs in the guidelines, and then make sure that those were applied in styles, because we received complaints from people studying of, like, they didn't know which one to study because they were slightly off. So in more cases than not, it was just reconciling those.
With human sight? Just curious how.
Okay. Yes. There was no laboratory analysis involved.
Got it. Thanks.
Great talk. Thank you. When the provisional guidelines came out to cover juicy IPAs, they were specifically aimed at New England IPAs. But when the 2021 update came out, it was hazy IPAs,
yeah,
which includes a whole lot more beers. It includes beers that don't use an S3 English ale yeast. So can you talk a little bit about the decision to put all those under one umbrella?
Yeah. And I kind of reference back to perhaps it was the 2008 guideline updates when we changed the name of Imperial IPA to Double IPA, because that's what the market seemed to be calling it. So in this case, we stopped trying to distinguish between them because it looked like the market had sort of settled on hazy more often than anything else. So we were following that, not trying to say that, and because literally everyone and their brother is making it. So while it may have originated in New England, it is no longer a New England phenomenon. You no longer have to travel to Vermont to get this. You go look for a hazy IPA, you're going to find one before you find a Starbucks. So that's why it changes. Our acknowledgement of this is what it's more likely to be called in the market.
When I think about looking towards the future, I think, you know, the category that makes the most sense to talk about is 34C experimental.
Mm.
As a judge, I sort of see two ends of the spectrum when I'm at the table with other judges. Some judges feel like if your OG is 10 points high for a Dunkel, then it's no longer a Dunkel, it falls under experimental. And some other judges feel like nothing is experimental and everything that ends up on that table would be better placed in another category. What's your philosophy?
That actually is a really good question. And that's you know, I'd love talking about that. We did purposefully try to kill experimental beer by, like, adding all these other categories where things could apply. Just because it made competitions harder to judge. So in this way, we're trying to get beers judged with similar beers to not abuse the palates of the judges. So if we can get the competition, the brewers, basically to self-organize when they submit it, then the organizer doesn't have to go through this enormous list of specialty beers and decide how they want to parcel them out. So I would say that the people that say there shouldn't be any beers there, no, there should. I mean, if it doesn't fit somewhere else, by definition, that's where it goes. I don't have a problem with that. That's what it's there for. But those could also include things that develop after we publish the guidelines. If some new technique or new ingredient comes out that drives a beer in a different direction, maybe it ought to go there while we're figuring it out. And that's the source that we look at to see should we be creating some new styles. So I'd encourage entry in there, because if we look at the competition entry data for those styles, maybe we'll learn something about styles we need to create. As far as if something's like 10 points over, can you taste that? If not, put it where you know the normal style is. If you can taste it, yeah, that's a perfectly fine place to go. I think we might have recast the mixed style category, the 34B style, to include things that are like imperial examples of things. Things that would include process changes. You know, that's where I tell people to enter Italian Pilsner, because a dry hop German Pilsner. So you took an existing style and you added dry hops. You know, there you go. So it's an out of style variation by employing a known technique.
So without getting too far into the specifics, would something like cold IPA be an example of something that you would put in 34C right now?
I haven't had enough examples of that. It would be either there or 34B, because it could be sort of you could make the claim that it's basically an American lager crossed with a American IPA. And that sounds an awful lot like what mixed style was. So we have this page on the BJC website called Style Entry Suggestions, where, you know, we get these kind of questions. Like, actually, Dennis gets these questions and, like, then turns around and asks me, like, well, what do we do with this thing? What do you think? And I don't know that we've received questions about that one in particular, but if I try a few more of them, I'll probably be able to tell. But if you made me choose right now, I'd probably say 34B.
Thank you. I want to thank you for the BJCP guidelines. I think they give us a target to shoot for, and I think as homebrewers, that's part of the process, is learning how to shoot for a style and blending the malts and the water and the hops all together to get there. I want to talk about one style, though, that is seems to be everything, so maybe it's nothing, and that's the IPA style. the juicy IPA is not really an IPA. It is based upon late hop additions, not early hop additions. Mm-hmm. It's as far removed from Pliny the Elder as anything else, and yet we put juicy IPAs, which is a fine style, by the way. I love it. It's a great beer. I brew them myself. But that's just fundamentally different than, let's say, a celebration L or a Pliny the Elder. And so I think it's time to just like create a separate style for them, because they are their own style.
Well, we did separate out hazy IPA. They're in a greater category, but they are their own style. So competitions could pick them up, but we're calling them what they're called in the marketplace. So
I understand that. But we took the British, the English IPA, and put it off in a separate category. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's underneath an entirely different area than the American IPAs.
Yep.
And you know, it seems to me that Juicy just has, I'm sorry, they're just late hop edition beers. And I understand we don't want to call them that, but that's just a fundamentally different process than brewing an IPA.
It could wind up in a different place in the future.
Yeah.
I I'm not averse to that. But they certainly get enough entries of them in a competition.
Oh, yeah, I know.
They wind up in their own category anyway, just because of the number that you receive. But yeah, when you made the statement about how juicy or hazy IPAs are so different from the original concept, I've given a presentation in South America about IPAs over the years, and one of the conclusions I had is pointing out the irony in a style that was designed to be shipped halfway across the world, you now can't take across the parking lot without it blowing up on you. So, your original point, I'd say point taken. So what we do about that? It's something for us to consider in the next major update. Yeah.
My question is more about beer judging.
Yeah.
In getting to know Pittsburgh, one beer at a time, I revisited some beers that I had earlier in the week that didn't quite taste the same the first time. So as a beer judge, as the beer judge yourself, I'm a national. I consider myself a decent beer judge as well. But how do you deal with those differences?
Well, you have to understand that, like, beer styles have a range to them. And that's something we saw in earlier editions of the guidelines, is that the guidelines were often written to describe a single favorite commercial style, example of a style. And then if somebody else made the style and was different, it would get marked as out of style. I made a trip to Dusseldorf to, like, check on alt beers because the original style was, like, written like, well, if you're not Zumerie, it's like out of style. And basically that example is so far out of, like, the mainstream of what everybody else is making that, the style had to be broadened. So if you're judging a style, my advice to judges is understand the range. Understand that multiple commercial examples can fit within the style, and it's okay. Judging beer isn't a beer cloning exercise, right? So there are different interpretations of the style that can be out there, and the better judges will realize that and appreciate the beers for what they are. What did this brewer execute that concept well? Not did they do the same thing as this other guy? Because I think, like, we all got into craft beer because we were tired of the days when, like, all beer tasted the same. And now that would be ironic if we were demanding that all beer tasted the same because we had these rigid guidelines. So, no, understand that there's a range to them and let brewers do their fun stuff and enjoy them for what they are.
So hopefully I'll be the last question.
Yeah, we're really going to get the hook.
So I've got a bit of a pointy question. Are the modern kruid ales, the herbal ales, still categorized under the historic beers?
The modern what?
The gruits.
Oh, we don't actually have a definition for that. And
so do I need to write one? Because right now they're categorized. Yes, I'm that one.
I've exchanged a number of emails with
under
you.
Under the historian. And they're not actually historian.
Yeah, yeah, and I've read your papers, and they're great. The question I had was whether we're describing a historical beer that people can execute today, or are we describing some modern reinterpretation of the beer? And I know you understand those are two separate things.
Yeah, I actually call them separately in my writings as well. The,
yeah.
The modern Gruet ales
yeah.
can be anything.
Yeah.
And I think they actually should have their own modern category because people
right.
love brewing with additives, with herbs, anti-hops and all that. But the medieval Gruet beers, I don't think you need a category for that because hardly anyone can even brew them because the ingredients are not
right.
available anymore.
Right. Right. And the conversation that I know we had over email before was sort of got back to part of the slides I had of the difficulty in building a sensory profile for that result in beer. Yeah. Maybe what this winds up being is more like a specialty beer that's more what you – it's like a choose-your-own-adventure. You're – if you constrain the kind of ingredients that somebody can use, whatever results from that experiment is in style for this thing we're coming up with. I just don't know how to describe that from a sensory standpoint.
And I think that's actually why I showed up in this talk, because now I'm understanding the styles better. It's the medieval version should be just under historic brewing.
Yeah.
The historic, that's clear. But the modern interpretation of the Gruet ales, that should be out of the historic because it has no basis to its historic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has no historic basis.
Yeah.
And with the books that are coming out and with, in our local homebrew club in the reenacting, people love brewing with herbs, thinking they're doing a historical thing, which they're not. So if there's a category where I can go that is not historic, that would be awesome.
Yeah, yeah. It is an area of interest of mine, obviously, since I exchanged emails with you on this. And for those in the audience that didn't catch the name,
V-E-R-G.
Look up some of her papers online. It taught me about some misconceptions of like medieval Gruet, of what herbs were in there, and I learned quite a bit from that.
Thank you.
And some of the other published, I would say some published data had been debunked as a result of that, but I'm not sure that helped me come up with a way to define these styles any better. So that's why. That's why it's a future work.
We'll just keep talking.
Yeah, thanks for coming, and thank all of you for staying on here. I enjoyed it.